McBride. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Court apologizes for the slight delay. As a preliminary matter, I wanted you to know that we've reviewed yesterday's submissions and we agree that the parties have reserved the right to proceed with the appeal without prejudice because the money was paid. So to that extent, there's no need to address it during today's oral arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Parker?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, Vernon Proctor. I'm here representing Windsor Tech, Inc., the appellant today. We're appealing from a decision of the Court of Chancery granting summary judgment to the plaintiff, David Loppert, that an enforceable settlement agreement was reached last May by an exchange of emails and correspondence between counsel. We're also appealing from a follow-up order on fees. It's Windsor Tech's position that Mr. Loppert has not demonstrated on the basis of the fairly slender paper record below that there's no material dispute of fact in several respects. And this court, in reviewing the matter, need not defer to those findings in any way. The mere fact that the parties agree that the record is a complete record of negotiations does not signify a concession that there's an agreement that all material terms were agreed to. And if the court will carefully review the record presented to the court in the appendices, the record of the negotiations, we believe the court will be satisfied that there were several material disputes that justify a reversal here. We believe the first issues emanate from the very first letter sent to Mr. Berger, who is the lead counsel for Windsor Tech, by Mr. Laster, counsel for Loppert. And that's the May 5th letter that's in the appendix. And it refers to discussions of settlement, discussions with respect to the parallel continuation of the Section 220 action. Language that signifies that the case should be dismissed after the discussions ceased. Even more important, in item 14 in Mr. Laster's first letter, there's a recital that the settlement agreement will contain customary and ordinary terms and provisions. And that's noteworthy for a couple of reasons. First, it suggests that the parties did in fact contemplate that the agreement be memorialized into a final written document and that an agreement on the basis of emails was not contemplated. Now, Mr. Berger rejected certain aspects of those initial 14 points by email. He specifically rejected item 14 as vague. He didn't know what are customary and ordinary terms. I have no idea what that is. So Mr. Laster's letter of May 6th contains a response to that. And it says at page 842 of the appendix, these terms will be memorialized in a settlement agreement. We think that's significant for a couple of reasons. First, it raises a material issue as to what the parties expected the agreement to be. And also, was it an email exchange, or did they intend a definitive written agreement to be required? That language certainly suggests the latter, and it's an open issue of a material fact which should have precluded summary judgment. It also raises the issue the parties have briefed from the Anchor Motor Freight case as to whether the parties positively agreed that a formal writing was required. And that's another issue that these opening letters suggest there was a dispute that should not have been resolved so early. We'll proceed to what I'd call the email trail. Once the first two letters are sent, then the parties relied exclusively on email, at least through May 7th. And there are other items in the record that suggest that the plaintiff hadn't decided whether to settle or litigate. There's a May 7th email at A64 where the plaintiff's attorney says, we need to hear from you by 5 p.m. today, otherwise we're content to move forward with the litigation. suggesting that if you, even if you just respond timely, litigation will be dropped. Then on May 10th, we have another email from the plaintiff's counsel to Mr. Berger, my co-counsel, and here's our proposal for the settlement agreement. I look forward to your comments. And that's after the May 7th, their position is that the last May 7th email closed the deal. But here again, they come back to the issue of whether, in fact, something more was required. Here's a proposal for the settlement agreement. I look for your comments. Look forward to your comments. And that refers right back, substantively, to the May 6th letter. And then finally, and we think crucially, there's a May 11th email from Mr. Laster to Mr. Berger, which is attached to the fairly voluminous exhibits to the draft settlement agreement, the draft definitive agreement. It says, since we have not yet signed up the deal, we will also be expecting your answer today. It doesn't say, since the scheduling order requires that you file an answer, file your answer. It says, since we have not yet signed up the deal, we will also be expecting your answer today. Again, that raises a material fact here on May 11th as to whether the parties had overtly manifested an intent to settle as of May 7th. And we believe that the court need go no further than that May 11th email to decide otherwise. And although Windsor Tech argues, although Mr. Loppert argues fairly forcefully that this is a dispute just akin to contract interpretation, it's not. We're not here arguing about the meaning of an unambiguous contract where parties agree there's a contract. What we're dealing with is whether a contract was even formed, at least at the summary judgment stage where the court made certain rulings we disagree with. This is an inherently factual issue. Issues of intent are implicated, and it's not ordinarily ripe for resolution by summary judgment. As the opinions we've put in our compendium, Boone versus Howard and Matter of NSTAR, recognize.
Mr. Proctor, I'd like to respond to something that's alluded to in the opinion and the briefs that's kind of in the vernacular, but it seems to have implications and importance for the Chancellor. And that is this use of the word deal. When the emails were going back and forth, there's this indication we have a deal, and then there's a subsequent reference to the fact that the deal isn't signed up. Then there's the final reference, the deal's off. But in reading the Chancellor's opinion, you seem to get the impression that if you have a deal, you have a deal, and that, you couldn't simply say the deal is off once you made the deal unless there was something in the deal that said if a certain condition wasn't fulfilled, it was off. So how do you respond to this suggestion that if you have a deal, you have a deal?
Well, I don't think you can read the term deal in a vacuum. I think it was first used by the other side, and then it's sort of adopted by my co-counsel. And it's not determinative because, once again, I keep coming back to this May 11th email. Since we have not yet signed up the deal, deal could mean it's a vernacular, as Your Honor said, for agreement. But there may not. There's a dispute of fact as to whether the parties had intended to resolve as of that point. So just using the term deal without more, while we think you can't view that final May 7th exchange in a vacuum without reference to what came after the following weekend. And the signification of the intent to proceed with litigation, that deal is off. We're not going to negotiate with you anymore. It could be another way of reading the same those same emails from my co-counsel. So that's the way I try to put that in context for the court. And since we believe the record shows that there's at least a material dispute of fact as to whether a definitive agreement was required, we've taken the position, and it's also supported by a review of the record, that the draft agreement that we actually got on May 10th contained additional and different terms sufficient to make that the equivalent of a counterproposal, which is another reason to suggest that summary judgment was premature. We don't contest that attorneys have authority to settle agreements or disputes for their clients. But what we do dispute is whether what happened here nailed us down by virtue of an email exchange on May 7th, and we get a settlement agreement on May 10th that has new and different terms that were in our brief. They were in Mr. Berger's affidavit below, which clearly spelled out what the new terms were and to some extent the extent to which the parties had talked about them. I think the most pertinent one here is the release. There is a point in the initial correspondence from Mr. Loppert's counsel. It's repeated in the May 5 and May 6 letters, where the parties are contemplating that there be a general release subject only to actions that may be necessary to enforce the settlement agreement. And then when we get the draft written document from the other side on May 10th, we see that there's another exception that we never talked about, and there's not referred to in the email exchange with regard to the releases. They thought that had been put to bed. But there was an exception for another contract obligation between Mr. Loppert and Windsor Tech, which is now, in fact, the subject of other litigation between the parties. So that's just the most salient example, in our view, of why the draft we got was actually a settlement, a counterproposal instead of just an implementation of what had been previously agreed to. I've referred already to the disputed fact that is reasonably inferable from the other side's insistence on continuing with the litigation, and although they premise their position pretty strongly on the existence of the scheduling order, you can't go that far. You have to put the scheduling order in context. The first case was a Section 220 action filed by Mr. Loppert against my client to review books and records. As this court well knows, those are contemplated to be summary proceedings. So that's filed in April, and Mr. Laster submits a draft of proposed scheduling order to me. My client thinks it's too aggressive. We counterpropose. And the plaintiff think that's not quick enough. We had a call with the chancellor early in the week of May 7th. It might have been that Monday. He gives us a trial date. We work back. And that's customary. And Mr. Laster did the first draft. And finally, we got around. I signed it on Friday the 7th, and it was filed. You can't really base any argument about the existence of the contract or the significance of an intent to litigate on the happenstance that we filed that scheduling order that day. Because it depends on the context in which it was filed. Finally, I will raise the point about there's a disputed fact about whether board approval was required, and this was something that became it came to the fore on May 10th when we got the draft definitive agreement, and this was something that would suggest that there's at least a material dispute as to whether the attorneys in fact did have the final say or whether there were other items that needed to be resolved. And among those, we put in our brief, it did involve this case was complicated. It was supposed to be a global settlement of all disputes between the parties. And it included a couple of items customarily reserved for boards, and the issuance of securities and options. I mean, that's statutory. That's one thing. And the other thing was they referred in their papers they wanted a Section 203 exemption for this transaction to take it out from under the tender offer statute. So again, there, Your Honors, there's enough in the record, in the paper record, to suggest at the very least that there's a material dispute of fact. Finally, as to attorney's fees, our position is very simple. Since there's no contract, the contract called for a loser pays provision on attorney's fees, we shouldn't have been required to pay attorney's fees. There was no finding by the chancellor of bad faith below. That takes us out from under the case law from this court's having to make its own independent finding on that issue. So the attorney's fees is very simple.
Well, if the deal included an agreement on attorney's fees and we uphold the chancellor on the existence of a deal, then his finding is appropriate, isn't it?
That's right. There's no question about it. In fact, we've already paid some attorney's fees, so that was the source of the court's jurisdictional concerns earlier in the week. So for all those reasons, Your Honors, we believe the entry of summary judgment was premature and it should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Laster, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Travis Laster on behalf of Appellee David Laubert. Mr. Laubert and his wife are with us today. In granting summary judgment, the Chancellor correctly applied this court's controlling precedent. He reached the right result on the facts. He also reached the right result as a matter of public policy in terms of using summary judgment and enforcing settlement agreements. Our position on appeal can be summed up in one sentence, which I will then unpack the three issues. First, the Chancellor correctly concluded that on this paper record, objectively read, the parties assented to the material terms of the settlement. The three issues that I'd like to run through are the fact that this is a paper record, it's an objective test, and that there was overt assent on May 7th to the terms of the settlement. First, the paper record. The parties agree that all of the substantive negotiations took place by email, and it was all before the court. The Chancellor noted that in his opinion. They conceded it below on page 8 of their opposition, which is found in B20 of the appendix, and they confirmed it on appeal. Quoting from their opening brief, page 17, note 7, those exhibits were adopted by Windsor Tech in opposition to the motion. So this is not a case where there is a dispute over did Mr. Laster say this or did Mr. Berger say that. All of the exhibits are in writing and the record is agreed upon. Now, they do mention in their briefs a phone conversation, but they can't say that anything substantive occurred or that there was any material fact. And for the first time in reply, they raised the idea that the negotiations actually went back months to Mr. Laubert's former counsel. But again, they don't say anything material happened. They don't identify a dispute of fact. That, frankly, is appeal by innuendo. This record is set, and it was all before the Chancellor. Contrast that with their cases, the Boone case, the Continental Oil case, where there was a dispute. It was either an oral agreement or there was a question of, did so-and-so say this? And those are the cases where on contract formation, it's inappropriate to grant summary judgment. But this is a paper record. And so I would submit that it was appropriate for the Chancellor, both as a legal matter and as a matter of public policy, to deal with this case on summary judgment. The second issue that I wanted to unpack is this court's governing test, because this is important. It is an objective test. In Industrial America, this court said that it's based on the standard of a reasonable negotiator. And what that means is that it is akin to summary judgment. When the Chancellor looks at an undisputed written record, his job, as this court has instructed him to do, is to determine what that third party would say. Now, contract cases on plain meaning are decided on summary judgment frequently. And when that happens, it's often true that one party says the plain meaning is this, the other party says the plain meaning is that. When you have an objective test, even on summary judgment does not demand that the judge go with the non-movement's interpretation. No, he's supposed to apply an objective reading exactly as he did here. And I've noted that this court, as recently as October 2004, affirmed that the principles of contract interpretation, objective interpretation, apply on contract formation. That's the Sussex Equipment versus Burke Equipment case, which we cited as page 19 of our brief. This court decided the formation question on summary judgment. In that case, the language was clear that it wasn't a final agreement, but this court applied that plain meaning objective standard that we say the Chancellor correctly applies. We've also cited in our cases, in our brief, two cases where the court similarly has granted summary judgment finding that a contract was formed, the Vincent Capano case and the Falcon Tankers case. Now, they try to distinguish both those cases in their reply, And I'd like to say to the court, there are some very aggressive statements in my friend's reply that we didn't provide the full story about cases or that we hid the ball in some way from the court. And as I know the court will, I think when the court reviews the citations, you will see that our citations are accurate and the distinctions are aggressive. For example, on the Vincent Capano case, they say, quote, it involved a fully executed negotiated contract, unquote. That's page 15 of the reply brief. When you look at the case, there was a negotiated contract. That was the background issue. The contract formation issue was whether the parties had agreed on a waiver, and that was decided on summary judgment on a paper record, just as we say was appropriate. Same in Falcon Tankers. They say it concerns the scope of the contract. If you look at the case, it was a battle of the forms with other written communications. It was contract formation, summary judgment granted on a paper record.
Mr. Astor, help us think through the implications of ruling in your favor, at least with regard to the issuance of the options. As I understand it, you eventually reached a deal at 1.1 million options. And the briefs discuss the authority of attorneys to bind their clients, which normally we know the general rule. And but in the event that we conclude that there was an agreement, what Mr. Proctor is telling us is that, notwithstanding the general authority of counsel to bind their clients, only a board can authorize the issuance of securities. What rule are we going to be announcing? And let's suppose the board says, well, I don't care what your attorney said on the phone, we're not going to issue the securities. Where does that go? What are your clients' rights?
Certainly, Your Honor. I would then have a damages remedy for the value of the options. A similar issue was addressed by Vice Chancellor Lamb. I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the case handy. But certificate of incorporation precluded the issuance of additional stock. The right was converted to a damages remedy. I do want to speak more about the board approval condition because I think the objective record here is quite clear. Board approval was never mentioned once during the negotiations of material terms between the 5th and the 7th. The idea of board approval was inserted in the draft agreement prepared by Loppert's counsel over the weekend and sent to Windsor Tech. It comes from the Loppert side. And how is it set in there? It's set in there as a representation. It's not a condition to contract formation. It's a rep by the other side that board approval has been given. And objectively, it's clear why that's in there. Reps protect the contracting party. That's in there because Mr. Loppert wasn't conducting due diligence to find out what their capital structure was to know whether he had a 203 problem. He knew he was at 14% and that he was going to get a lot of options. So rather than doing the due diligence, you protect yourself with a rep. The idea that that was some understanding that board approval was required is completely manufactured after the fact. That's a protective provision for Loppert that comes in from the Loppert side. And, Your Honor, we understood the 157 issue, we understood the 203 issue, and those provisions were put in there to protect Loppert. It was never a condition of the deal. But Your Honor is exactly right. If this court affirms the Chancellor's ruling that the May 7th statement, we have a deal at 1.1 options, answer, good, I'll let the company know, overtly manifested assent, as we contend it did, then we would have a right to those options, and if they breached that right by not giving us board approval, we would have a right to damages equal to the value of those options. Your Honor, the third issue that I wanted to touch on with the court is the one that I just identified, which is the overt manifestation of assent. I think the record on this is quite clear. If I were selling my brother-in-law's car to a member of the public, and after dickering over price, they said to me, we have a deal at $1,000, and I said, good, I'll let my brother-in-law know, everyone in the world would think we had a deal. And no one would think that simply because we hadn't talked about the time of delivery, we didn't have a deal. The law would imply a reasonable time. No one would think that because we didn't talk about whether it was going to be cash or check, we didn't have a deal. The law would imply a reasonable provision on that. The key issue there would be the material terms were price, car. Just like here, the material terms that were negotiated were those terms that were in the exchanges between May 5th and May 7th. And I'd point out that Mr. Berger, as Mr. Proctor noted on his statement, understood he was negotiating material terms. Why? because he wanted that customary language provision out of the May 5th email. He wanted to know exactly what he was agreeing to, that those were the deal points, and that's clear from the objective record. And I also would suggest, Your Honor, again, there's no dispute about the facts. May 6th letter is in the record at 840 through 41. That sets the initial deal points. The customary and ordinary concept is out at Mr. Berger's request. Berger counters on 5 points. That's at A62. Loppert accepts all of his points except the number of options. That's at A64. Parties agree on 1.1 million options. All material terms are set at that point. With the court's permission, I'd like to address some of the objections that Windsor Tech has raised. The first objection is that Mr. Loppert has not fulfilled his obligations under the agreement, that he hasn't performed. Well, I think that the emails that my friend submitted in response to the court's January 24th inquiry show that we did indeed perform. Regardless, that issue, in my mind at least, and I think in the Chancellor's, goes to performance under the contract, not under contract formation. But in fact, the performance that we were required has been tendered. I said earlier about the aggressive statements in the reply brief, and this is one here. This argument about Loppert's own obligations was not raised below. And this is the point that we say in our answering brief at page 23 was not raised below. They come back in a footnote in their reply brief at page 15, note 3, and they say, that's simply not true. They're talking about a different argument. They talk about the argument about the litigation continuing, and they cite to the lower court on that. It's shifts passing in the night. That first position was not raised below. Now, second, I'd like to address the point that the email supposedly only would be used for settlement purposes and that there was something untoward about then using those emails to establish an agreement. This point was raised and rejected below. The documents did say for settlement purposes only, but as the Chancellor's opinion makes clear, under Rule 408, overwhelming weight of authority, and indeed Hornbook law, one purpose for which settlement communications can be used is to enforce the settlement agreement. So there could not be any misrepresentation or dispute of fact about that. If anything, perhaps there was a misunderstanding of law on someone's point, but that issue is not a material dispute of fact. Another point that Windsor Tech makes is that there purportedly would be no binding agreement until a formal settlement agreement was executed. And they ask the rhetorical question, well, why did he furnish a settlement agreement if we had a deal on May 7th? And the answer to that is clear. The parties understood and agreed that the terms would be memorialized in a settlement agreement. That's in the May 6th letter to 842, where it says these terms will be memorialized in a settlement agreement. There is a key distinction under this court's law going back 70 years to the Universal Products case and recently reaffirmed in 1998 in the Anchor Motor Freight case, that there's a fundamental distinction between everybody understanding that you're eventually going to have a formal agreement and positively agreeing not to be bound until the formal agreement. The Chancellor correctly found that this was the former, simply an understanding that there would be a formal settlement agreement and not the latter. And I think it's helpful to look at cases in which this court and other Delaware courts have found a positive agreement not to agree and the types of things that was required. Sussex Equipment, which I referenced earlier, here's the language conspicuously underlined in the final paragraph, quote, this is an agreement in principle subject to final negotiations. That's enough to postpone being bound. Gilinardo case, quote, buyer and seller will attempt in good faith to finalize the sale agreement, but no party has or shall have any obligation to the other. That's enough. The Morgan case in our brief. These items are thoughts at this time and will be reviewed with an accountant and attorney. That's the type of thing that's enough. The Miller case that my friends like so much because the Chancellor authored it himself. Counsel shall negotiate in good faith to reach mutually acceptable terms. These are the types of things that go beyond mere memorialization to reach the level of postponing. There's no similar language in this case. Windsor Tech's counsel understood that he was negotiating the material terms. He understood that that he would be bound, and indeed he represented that he had settlement authority by saying 1.1 million is all I have. The only way to read that is he's saying, I have authority for 1.1 and can close the deal on 1.1, but I can't go any higher. Now, I'd like to focus on the continuation of the 220 action, because that is really the heart of this appeal. In other words, if we had a deal on May 7th, why did the 220 action continue, and why did Loppert expect Windsor Tech to file its answer on the 11th, on Tuesday? Well, the first answer is there was a scheduling order, and Mr. Proctor tries to dismiss that order as just something that happened to be in the air. But as the Chancellor noted, that order was binding on the parties, and it controlled the litigation going forward. Mr. Proctor says that it's important to understand that this was a summary 220 proceeding, and I agree with that. That scheduling order had a series of dates in it, and as is often the case in expedited proceedings, those dates are highly compressed. If you lose one, you potentially lose all of your deadlines. So there's always a risk in any case like that that a party will behave strategically, particularly a party that's opposing the expedited proceeding, and use settlement to try and get the proceeding off track. To guard against that, that case continues until the stipulation of dismissal is filed. That's what we said at the outset. That case will continue. And when it came to Tuesday, I think it's clear from the objective record what Mr. Loppert and his counsel were trying to do, what I was trying to do. We were trying to hold their feet to the fire. We had a deal on May 7th. Everybody knew it. The next step was to memorialize that deal. And why did we want that litigation to continue? To hold their feet to the fire on memorialization so we wouldn't have to be here for exactly this type of proceeding. It's common sense that it's easier to fight over a memorialized agreement than to argue about whether or not you have a deal or not. We were trying to hold their feet to the fire. There's no doubt we had a deal. And Justice Holland, in answer to your question to my friend, absolutely the statements that between the attorneys saying we have a deal because we haven't signed up the deal, the objective reading of that is a deal exists, but the memorialization hasn't happened yet. And the answer to that is, effectively, I'm going to blow up the deal. That's an understanding that there is a deal. There's no other way, objectively, to read those communications. I'd like now to touch on the alleged differences between the draft agreement and the settlement. And these, Your Honors, are really red herring arguments. They object to its length, whether the terms are boilerplate. They say these are all disputes of fact. Well, the issue here is the enforcement of the terms as they existed on May 7th, that Friday, not the follow-on agreement. The Korebsko case, which we've cited in our papers, 620F sub 1239, exactly this type of situation. There was an exchange of letters, a finding of a contract. The plaintiff's attorney was going to do a follow-on agreement. The other side said, wait. That follow-on agreement contains terms we didn't agree to, and it has more into it than we agreed to it. This case applying Delaware law, what the district court did was enforce that letter agreement, and he recognized that the follow-on agreement didn't create disputes of fact. If the draft was incorrect, as we've said in our papers, they simply could have sought reformation. The deal was what was existed on May 7th. Now, I'd also like to point out that none of those terms, I don't think, are material. The types of things they object to that were put into the draft agreement were timetables for performance. Well, otherwise the law is going to imply a reasonable time for performance. And also provisions on the piggyback and registration rights. Well, based on the papers that we've put into the record, we know that subsequently they've granted us the registration rights. So those provisions were surplusage. They've been able to comply with the contract, even those provisions of it. The May 7th deal is clear-cut. The additional provisions that were in the draft agreement, they would have been helpful. They would have clarified some timelines, but they weren't material provisions. Now, I'd also like to touch on this idea that there was some dispute about the scope of the release and the implications of that for the other litigation that's been filed. There's no dispute about the release that was agreed to. The language is right there. That's the contract formation issue. We put in the language, Berger said all acceptable, except, and he identified other things. So the language of the release as it exists on May 7th is there. There's no dispute of fact. Now, there may be a dispute from my friends about the scope of the release. But that's a different issue. That's a contract interpretation issue. Now, we've explained in our supplemental papers why the litigation we filed is consistent with the release. We've enforced the note, which was specifically included in the settlement agreement, and we've sought to enforce an obligation related to the note against individuals, not against Windsor Tech. The release was a Windsor Tech Loppert obligation. Contrast that with claims we haven't brought. Mr. Loppert believes he has derivative and class claims relating to Windsor Tech. Those are the subject of the release. We've held off on bond bringing those because we think that we're bound. I will pass over the fee award and rely on my briefs for that. I'd like to conclude by addressing the questions in the reply that Windsor Tech identifies as framing this case. Did the parties intend the emails to serve as a binding agreement? Yes. The attorneys clearly had authority and knew they were negotiating material terms. Did the parties allow their attorneys to bind them? Yes. Same thing. The emails show both sides have settlement authority. Did they agree on all material terms? Yes. And was there an overt manifestation of assent? Yes. Your Honors, we respectfully request that this decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Rose, just a couple of brief points. With respect to the all material points agreed to by May 7th, there's at least a dispute of fact on that. These are milestones on the way for the Leeds case, and as Leeds shows, you can think you have an agreement, but things happen between when you think you have an agreement and a definitive agreement, and ultimately you don't have an agreement. So we don't think that what was agreed to on May 7th is definitive as to whether there was a contract here, an overt manifestation of intent or not. Again, the test is that is a reasonable negotiator. And on this paper record, when you go back to the early correspondence, which reasonable readings would appear to say, would contemplate that there be a definitive agreement down the road once basic points are agreed to or hashed out to go forward. When you see in the very initial stages about customary and ordinary points being included in a settlement agreement, this would lead a reasonable reviewer of the record to conclude that that's something that the parties were going to do. So, again, Your Honors, this is a summary judgment record, and in formation cases, an NSTAR case and others show courts are historically reluctant to grant summary judgment in cases like this. We believe there's no reason to depart from the norm here, and the reversal is mandated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Foster and Mr. Lester. The court appreciates your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement, and the court will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All matters pertinent having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honor of the court.